This is Sign Language with Bruce Williams and Doc Goldstein.
Hi, and welcome to episode 169 of Sign Language. This is Bruce Williams from signlanguagepodcast.com.
And this is Doc.
And joining me from LA. How are you, Doc?
I'm good.
Excellent.
I'm using a different mic tonight, you know? This has been musical mics in the last few shows, right?
Right.
I was using my old 87 that looks like a drummer had his way with it, you know? It got too close to a tom-tom, obviously.
Yeah. Or,
you know, and I just, you know, I just got busy and I just didn't pull it out. And I had recorded some hand claps recently into a different mic, and I'm using that now tonight.
Okay.
Last episode, I used an old Shure SM7, which is, you know, a classic.
Oh, they're a great mic.
And it doubles as a hammer, so that's good.
Yes.
So tonight I have a mic made down in your neck of the woods.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a Rode, you know, R-O-D-E. Yep.
Yes.
NT1A is the model number.
Okay, cool.
So it's a large diaphragm cardioid condenser.
Yep.
Doesn't have any fancy switches on it. It's not a real expensive mic at all.
Yep.
But I use it a lot. It sounds really good. I use it all the time on stuff like acoustic guitars and things like that.
Well,
anyway,
what I'm hearing over Skype sounds great, and I'm sure it'll sound even better when I get the WAV file from you. So
cool.
Funny story though. When I first moved to Sydney in '96, I was actually living about 2 kilometers from their factory, which is about a mile and a half in your language. So.
Yeah. Right, right. We talk different here.
Yeah.
Like earlier, we were emailing and you used a word I had no idea what that meant until you spelled it out for me. And we'll not talk about that. No.
I always try and be mindful of the fact that with podcasts, your audience is always potentially global. So I always try and keep things like that in the back of my mind. Like if I talk about temperature, I always mention that it's Celsius. I'm not talking Fahrenheit and things like that, you know, because obviously, you know, American, you know, you guys use Fahrenheit, you use miles, and, you know,
right.
The different conventions in Europe to some of the conventions we have in Australia and all that sort of thing. So, yeah, I always try and keep that stuff in the back of my mind.
So here's the question. Here's the almighty question for today. Is it kilometer or kilometer?
That's an interesting one, and I don't really know what the official stance is.
I hear them both.
Yeah, I must admit that sometimes I even flip between the two. I'm really not sure what the what the proper designation is.
So. Right, and that has a lot to do with sound. But what the heck?
Yeah,
you know, we're here. So
yeah, exactly. So the news this week is that I've lost my job. For those who haven't, who aren't friends with me on Facebook and who may not have seen or heard this, I got retrenched on Monday from my position of 9 years as sound designer at the Australian Radio Network, which was not entirely a shock in the sense that it had been obvious that the workload was dropping, but it still hits you as a shock when it happens. So they had 3 sound designers and they said, we can't sustain 3 anymore. We need to lose one of you. And unfortunately, I was the unlucky guy that got tagged. So, yeah, so I'm in the marketplace now, which is an interesting place to be.
Consider this podcast an advertisement.
Yeah, exactly. But you know what, Doc? I've always lived by the philosophy that one door closes, another one opens. And I think is probably the universe giving me a bit of a push to say, get out there and look for other opportunities because there are other things around that you're not aware of. Because when you're in the comfort and safety of a, you know, a regular paycheck, you tend not to be looking for those other opportunities because, yeah, there's a paycheck coming at the end of the week, and so it doesn't really matter.
Well, it's also the fact that you're really busy, and so you're wrapped up in doing the job, so you don't really think about looking for a different job because you're just too busy doing the one you have.
Well, unfortunately, I wasn't. That was the thing. Maybe I should have taken that as a warning that that it wasn't going to last forever, but I honestly didn't think it was going to happen like this, but anyway. It did,
right.
And now I have to deal with it. So, I got a reasonable kind of a payout for 9 years of service. So I'm not totally stressed if I don't have a job next week, but I will be wanting to find some work pretty soon because I think I'd just go bored if I was sitting at home all day, every day.
Oh, yeah. Daytime TV. Can't beat it.
Don't go there. Yeah. So you're talking about hand claps.
Oh, that's right. Well, so there's a bunch of friends that I record occasionally. They're called the New 30.
Right.
Because they're all like my age, you know.
So, oh, okay.
You know, they pull up in their covered wagons. You know how it is.
Nice.
So, so anyway, they do classic rock. So I sent them a mix of the last thing we did, which was a Queen song, and they wanted me to add hand claps to it.
Right.
Or at least they want to try it. So I had some choices to make. You know, I could have the whole band come over and clap around the microphone, which wasn't feasible because they're busy, like everybody's busy.
Yep.
And we might have done that, but we didn't. So then I started thinking about the best way to do it. And I decided almost instantaneously that I was not going to use a sample. I wasn't going to dig into the library and pull out some hand claps.
Sure.
I just don't think that would work with classic rock, and I wanted to keep some authenticity, you know?
Yep.
So I went into Pro Tools, and I set up a mic, and I did 8 hand claps tracks myself.
Yep.
And the first 4 were with the SM57 that we used in the last podcast. It was still sitting here.
Yep.
And then for the last 4, I used this Rode that I discussed, the NT1A.
Sure.
And I did it just so that I, you know, have a different sound. And also, I also mixed them up by making a choice between, on some of them, my hands were in left hand high, and in the other claps, they were low. It was left hand low, and it changed the sound of the hand claps. It was like I was left-handed, and then I was right-handed.
For sure.
And I did not want to have every hand clap be exactly perfect. So I haven't done it yet, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to take those hand claps and probably double them.
Yeah,
you know, electronically, and pan them left and right. See, and I'll be checking mono to make sure that there's no problems in mono because I always do that. And you should all take that advice. So maybe I'll talk about that. But anyway, so I'm going to have hand claps that sound more like people actually did them because I did them. I mean, again, if you go back and listen to early Beatles songs, they did hand claps themselves right there. You know.
Yeah.
And it just sounds better than taking a sample and having everyone be exactly the same. You know, that just gets really, you know, I don't like it.
No.
To quote my grandson, I don't like it, you know. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. I'm sure it'll be fine. I will do some editing.
It's interesting that you bring this up because my mate Dave, who I've been recording music with for, best part of 20 years now, we did a track. Probably earlier this year, and we wanted to do hand claps as well. So what we did was, rather than clapping along to the actual song, and the reason we didn't do that was because you always end up with some headphone bleed. So what we did was we just moved the cursor down past the end of the song, hit record, and the pair of us went in. And stood beside the mic, and we just set our own tempo, and we then just did probably 20 different hand claps with both of us clapping together. And what I then did was I created a whole new project, dragged that WAV file into that project, sliced each one of these hand claps in so that each audio clip was only one hand clap, and then just dragged them all down to adjacent tracks. So I ended up with about 20 tracks side by side that had 2 people clapping in them, and we varied the distance to the microphone as we recorded. So you get some that sound like the hands are a bit closer to the mic than some others, and like you, I then panned all of these tracks into different parts of the stereo scope, and ended up with this thing that sounded like about 40 people clapping. And
sounds great. Sounds like it's really good.
Yeah. So it sounds like you and I were pretty much on the same page in terms of technique.
Yeah. Well, I just wasn't gonna take a hand clap sample.
Yeah.
I just There are so many reasons why I wouldn't do that.
Well, that all the samples will always be so overprocessed, and if the classic rock thing that you're doing is not, you know, overprocessed the way a lot of today's music is, then it would sound completely incongruous with that style of music.
Yeah, there are a lot of styles of music now. I can think of one style in particular where they actually don't have a snare drum. They have a hand. They have hand claps instead.
Yep.
And I'll be honest with you, that's kind of like turned me off to the hand claps because after, I mean, it's a good sound at first.
Yeah.
But after a while, you hear it, you know, so much that it just got old. So I didn't want to do that. and I, again, I just didn't think it would be, was appropriate for the style of music either.
Yeah.
And you always got to record to this, you know, something that makes sense to the style of music you're doing. You know, if I was doing really processed pop music, maybe a sample would have been good.
Yeah.
You know, and I've nothing against doing that, but this wasn't that case.
Yeah. So these mates of yours in this band, they're doing covers of old classic rock tracks. Are they aiming for a sound representative of that era, or are they trying to put a modern sound on it?
No, I think they're trying to sound like the old days, you know, if the song calls for it. They're not going ultra modern, you know.
Kind of like what the Black Keys do.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the Black Keys don't have a modern overprocessed sound.
No.
In fact, I think they work very hard not to, actually.
Yeah.
And, you know,
exactly.
And that's completely valid. It's, you know, it wouldn't fit their music to have an overly processed mix sound. That just would not work for what they're doing.
No.
So same thing here, you know.
Yeah, right. Cool. Now, last episode, you made reference to signal flow, and you said something about three paths.
Oh yeah.
And I made a note of it because I wanted to explore that a little further. What did you mean by that?
Well, my students who sometimes listen to this podcast, this will sound familiar to them because they've heard me drill it into their heads, but let's just back up a little bit and just say that professional large format mixing consoles, dinosaurs though they might be, have their uses, and they have similarities. Even, you know, if you have an SSL or a Neve, you know, or an API or any console that's large format analog console, and even many of the digital ones, they have a lot of signal paths in common. It's like a car. When you get in a car, you know there's going to be a radio switch. You just don't know where it is if it's a new car. You know there's going to be a switch that turns the air conditioning on and off. And consoles are the same way. You know, there's going to be a headphone feed, or likely 12 or so. There's going to be, you know, faders, you know, up is louder, you know, big deal, right? Yep. And you know that there's going to be EQ. So once you get used to a console, one is like another in terms of working it.
Yep.
But I always teach my students that there's three basic signal paths that if they keep it straight in their minds, it'll help them not be confused in a session when there's a bunch of stuff going on, especially if you're doing basic tracks and there's, you know, you got the band in there, you got the bass player's future ex-wife in there, and you got all these extra people.
Yeah.
So the three paths are, the way I think about it, is path one is from the microphone to the recorder, whatever that may be.
Right.
In my case, it's usually a Pro Tools, but what if it was a 24-track? That'd be okay, or if it was a different workstation, that'd be fine. Path one is still microphone to the recorder.
So the input path, if you like.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay.
And path two is from the recorder back to the console to the mix bus.
Yep.
And then path three is the headphone mix, which is always coming back from the recorder. I never send headphones from the mic channels, and we can talk about that, but, you know, playback doesn't work so well for headphones when you're coming from the mic channels because there's nothing there, so,
right.
And I teach that, but, so those are the three paths. So, for example, if a student thinks he's got everything hooked up right, and he sees it on Pro Tools when it's on input, or he sees it when he's recording, but he doesn't hear it, well, if he sees it there, path one must be working, path two must not be.
Right.
So it helps them not be confused, because people who run consoles like this will know immediately that you might have a microphone coming on one channel, but it's going to a totally different tape channel. So there can be confusion, especially when people are starting out trying to figure out, you know, what is what. So if they just think about the three paths, it helps them from getting confused so quickly. You know, it really helps.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Interesting. So on the console, we have it's easy to, for example, to put the EQ on the side of the console that's going to the tape recorder or Pro Tools, or you can have it on the monitor side, which is headed to the mix bus, but it's not being recorded to the multitrack or Pro Tools. It's a playback thing.
Yep.
And I'm old school, so I think that it's fine to make some decisions when you're recording so you don't have to make so many later on.
For sure.
You know, and I don't mic every guitar ever dubbed with 16 tracks of different mics in different areas and mics across the street and all this stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I try to make a decision as I'm recording it, what I'm going to do later, you know, if I, you know, or because I've been doing this long enough to where I know what I have to do to make it sound a certain way, and I kind of get a picture in my head of what it's going to sound like. Sometimes, though, it's not bad to save some decisions until later, but, you know, you just don't want to open up a mix and have 200 tracks of different amp mics. You know, it's just ridiculous. So,
yeah.
But again, that all gets back to the three pass because you can keep it simple that way. In fact, the other night we recorded at school and we got a great drum sound and didn't use any EQ at all.
Yeah, absolutely.
We did, you know, it was proper miking, choice of microphones and how they were placed and how the drums were tuned and a good drummer because you can't do that without a good drummer.
Yeah.
So we had a pair of KM-184s on the overheads, which are very transparent, small diaphragm condenser mics.
Yep.
We had, I think the model number is a Telefunken dynamic kick drum mic. I think it's an M82.
Right.
It's kind of a large diaphragm dynamic microphone, and it's got some nice EQ on the mic itself
that
you can use. Right. And then we use the handy dandy SM57 on snare, which is not unusual.
Yep.
And then we had an AKG 451 on the hi-hat, pointed straight down at the hat, not at an angle away from the snare drum. And that's intentional because microphones, when you get off axis, their frequency response gets worse as the frequency rises.
Sure.
So I'd rather have a little snare leakage and a clearer high frequency harmonic content than try to get rid of the leakage by aiming the mic and then it sounds terrible up past 8K.
Yeah, right. Nice.
You know, yeah. Now, some people like a mic on the bottom snare. In parentheses, you might want to throw that out of polarity because it's aimed the opposite to the other mics.
Exactly. Yep.
Parentheses closed. So Tom Toms were all Sennheiser 421s.
Yep.
They're great. Which is one of my favorite mics for a lot of things.
Yeah, they're great for toms.
They are. They're also great for some woodwinds and brass. They're great for brass.
Right.
Although I prefer a 441 on trumpet, but. Okay. If I don't have one, 421s are great. And 421s, by the way, Sennheiser 421s, sound really good on guitar amps.
Right.
They really do.
Okay.
You know, they're mellower than putting a Shure on there.
Yeah.
A lot less mid-range boost. And obviously, ribbons sound great on guitar amps.
Yep.
So we do that with Royers.
Yeah.
Nice. You know? And it sounded really good. The drums sounded just fine. We didn't have to do anything to it. Level was easy. You know, we only had phantom power on three mics, right? The hi-hat and the two overheads.
Right.
And everything else we didn't need phantom power on. And then the bass went direct through basically a transformer in a box that I had. It's just a Jensen transformer. That's all it is in the box. And the guitar player was a 57 up against his amp grill cloth, right on axis with the cone of the speaker.
Yeah, right.
And really close to the amp, like maybe an inch and a half away from the grill cloth. It was right on it.
Yeah, right.
You know.
See, I never mic a guitar like that, an electric. But that's
right.
But that's the beauty of, you know, this whole art form is you know, I personally will I'll go into the room and I'll tell the guitarist, okay, Play for me what you're going to play, you know, whether it's a chord progression or, you know, whatever it is. And I will move my head around in front of the amp. And depending on how loud that amp is, I will find the spot where I feel like, you know, all the tones really come together. And in my experience, that's always, you know, maybe 18 inches to 24 inches out from the amp. And I'll quite often put the mic that far out.
Well, I've had good luck trying that. I've put a KM84 about 18 inches back and had good luck with that in the past.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know if I'd use your method if I was recording a bunch of triple rectifiers doing death metal. You know, I'd be
right.
I'd be really careful about that.
Okay.
But I think this proves that recording and just audio in general is an art and a science.
Sure.
Sure. You know, it helps to know this part of the science, but not to the point where it gets in the way of the art, right? Where would the Beatles be if you didn't break rules?
Exactly.
But breaking rules doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to clip this digital track. You know, you need to know something.
Yeah. Some things are just plain bad ideas.
That's right. So what do you do when you have a client who's got a bad idea? How do you handle that?
I would do my best if I had the knowledge within my head to explain to them why it was a bad idea. I would try and explain it from a scientific point of view as to why that was a bad approach, but I would be reluctant to do that if I didn't have a valid suggestion for a way to do it better.
Yeah.
If I knew something was a bad idea, but I still couldn't come up with a better idea, I'd go along with it. I'd probably, you know, keep my reservations to myself, but the minute that it became obvious that it was a bad idea from, you know, having recorded and played back and it was then obvious that it was a bad idea, I would then say, hey, that's not really working, but I'm not sure why. Has anyone got any other ideas on ways we could make it better? But if from the very outset a client has, you know, suggested an approach and I've known instinctively that's a really bad idea and I can think of a much better way of doing it, I would probably do the political thing, which would be, let's do it your way first, and when it falls flat, then I'll say, look, here's why I think that didn't work, and I think this way would probably work better. Are you happy to give that a go? And most of the time, people will go along with you.
You're very patient and diplomatic. I salute you for that. You know, I wish I had that gene.
Mate, that's 30 years of dealing with radio clients, mate.
So one thing that I have seen is that if a client has a bad idea and you tell them that it might not be the best thing to try, you just might lose their trust and they immediately might think, depends on the client, but they might end the relationship. But they might think, oh, this guy isn't on the same page I am. Yep. He's not open to my suggestions, and they begin to shut down. So I'll do what you do a lot of the time. You know, I'll try it and I won't say anything bad about it and let them tell me, oh, that didn't work.
Yeah.
You know. I was
Just to pursue that thought a little further is if they've suggested what I think is a bad idea and we go ahead and we record it and we play it back and it sounds like a bad idea and the client says that's great.
Oh God.
I would probably at that point say, can we just try something before we move on to the next thing? And then I would
keep it.
Yeah. So I would keep their horrible take. You know, it might be microphone choice. It might be microphone placement. It might be, you know, whatever this bad decision is, I would keep their version, but then try what I felt was going to be a better approach and then let them listen to both. And hopefully they will see the light of day. And if they don't, and they're still enamored with their original, you know, what I consider to be a bad idea, at that point, I just let it go. Because I think, hey, they're the one paying the bill. If that's what they want and they're happy with it, who am I to say, no, you can't do it that way, you know? So that's
exactly. You can't say that. You can't say that. You have to give them their artistic freedom. And at the same time, you have to have their back. You have to cover them in some way.
Yeah.
You know, so I'll tell you a true story, but I can't tell you the names.
That's okay. Names are changed to protect the guilty.
Yeah. So I wasn't mixing. This was somebody else because, you know, I'm a tech, right? I do a lot of that. So I was in a film mixing room. They were mixing a movie where the client, the director, had an incredibly successful movie not you know, too long before this, just a couple of years. So
right.
The guy had endless money and time, and he was a very nice person, but he had some funny ideas about how he wanted the mix. So what he asked for, and anybody out there that mixes a movie or TV show is going to cringe when I say this, but he wanted to put, for one cue, one musical cue in this program, he wanted to put all the music in the surrounds.
Right.
Okay, so...
what was his reasoning for it?
He just wanted to hear how it would sound, I think. He didn't really say, but we all knew, by we, I mean the mix crew and myself,
yeah,
that might sound just fine in the mix room where all the surround speakers and the power amps and the room EQ and the acoustics and everything is like as perfect as you can make it and bulletproof.
Yeah.
But when played back in a small theater like in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, you know, or someplace like that, where they don't have the budget to really keep the theater up, it might play through the surrounds. And a lot of surrounds in smaller theaters, and this is not really about Moose Jaw, that was just, you know, a joke, but smaller theaters that don't have a lot of money, you'll often find out if you test the systems that the surrounds have woofers missing,
right,
or diaphragm, high-frequency diaphragm, and the horn is not there, or completely fluttering in the breeze, and just all kinds of bad stuff happens out there in the field.
Yeah.
So, you know, they might try that, and it would sound great in the mix room, but it would play around the world, you know, just really, really badly. But we got lucky. He heard it, didn't like it, and they moved on. And everybody sort of gave each other a knowing glance and kept going.
And breathed a huge sigh of relief.
Totally, totally. You know, I had another client, and I cannot tell you who this was.
No.
I wish I could, but, you know, that would be unprofessional for me to give away some of the stuff if I told who it was. But we had a client that mixed a show. This was a feature in a place that wasn't up to snuff. I don't know where it was, to be honest with you, but it was Amateur Night Mixing Incorporated. It was not a good, it was set up wrong. They obviously had their monitors not set up right because the surround track on this show was about 10 to 12 dB too hot.
Oof. Youch.
And, you know, that was really bad. So they brought it over and we played it and the person in charge, you know, the client artist in this case, looked at me and asked me what I thought. And I said, well, I think you need to either remix it or turn the surrounds down 12 dB because you're going to have a big problem out in the field. And he looked at me in a way that you never want to have a client look at you.
Right.
He looked at me, you know, he looked at me like I was not standing there.
Right.
You know, he looked right through me and walked away, and I don't know if they ever went back and fixed it or not, but the movie turned out to be a hit,
right?
Which is great. You know, I'm happy for that. And they may have gone back and fixed that. I do not know.
Right.
But sometimes you just have to tell the truth in as diplomatic way as possible. That's not easy to do if something is really just like bad.
Definitely. You know? And I, you know, from my own perspective, I feel like, you know, over the 30 years of my career, I've learned to read clients pretty well when they're in my studio. And right. I can sort of feel how far I can go with that type of, you know, recommendation or critique. You know, some people you kind of feel like they're already on edge, so you've got to be really gentle with how you break that kind of news to them. There are other clients that, you know, I win them over with, you know, a joke and a smile at the beginning, like when they first walk in the door. And, you know, once you've got them on side, it's so much easier to approach things like that and go, hey, listen, you know, I'm not convinced that that's working. Can we give something else a go? You know, and this is the something else, you know, and most of the time, you know, I'm pretty successful with that approach. But
well, it's very possible that my perception and my memory of that occasion might not be encumbered by the facts that possibly I wasn't as smooth as I could have been. You know?
Right.
Right. I don't let facts get in the way of what I'm doing.
Right. Okay.
Right. So it's possible that from his perspective, I was just being not helpful.
Right.
And my perception was that I was trying to help this person.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But it's possible that I wasn't as diplomatic. I just don't remember. but I do remember how this person looked at me.
Yeah.
It wasn't good.
Yeah, right.
It wasn't good.
You know. Oh dear. Hey, we got some email come in over the last couple of weeks, which is great. It's nice to know that there are some people out there listening.
Yes.
And I thought I would read four of them. The first one is from Lewis Inglis. And he said, "Hi there. I just started listening to the latest episode, so I thought I'd email in. I enjoy the podcast, particularly since Doc joined. I listened to or have listened to pretty much every audio or recording podcast I can find. And one thing that keeps me listening to yours is the clear and unhyped discussion of basic principles and techniques. There's so much hype and fluff around these subjects sometimes it can get exhausting. I'm a self-recording musician. I'm pretty experienced, or at least I've been at this a long time. I mainly record with Reaper." Good stuff, Lewis. Woohoo! Waving the flag. "I'm always looking to understand audio and recording better, mainly to improve my own productions, but it's also just a nerdy interest. I'm happy with the podcast the way it is. Hearing two people who have practical, real-world experience in audio just talk about it is helpful to me anyway. As a home recordist in today's audio environment, it's easy to be distracted from the things that are actually most important. So some dispelling of myths and reinforcement of good practices might be helpful. I'm sure there's a lot that you two take for granted that would be useful information for someone like me. Anyway, that was a bit of a ramble, but thanks for the effort you put in so far, and keep it up if you want. Cheers, Lewis." So thank you, Lewis.
So is this signed by your mother or what? I mean, you know.
So I thought that little bit at the end, I'm sure there's a lot that you two take for granted that would be useful information to someone like me. I thought that was interesting because it is so easy, you know, when, you know, two guys like you and I, who collectively probably got about, you know, 150 years in the business.
Well, if there's a mistake to be made, we've probably made it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But he's right, though. You know, there's probably things that you and I just take for granted, you know, that, you know, sometimes even we don't realize just how much we take that knowledge for granted because we've been doing it that way for so long that it's just second nature. It's like breathing.
I have had people say to me, "How did you do that so fast?" I get that a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if something needs to be EQ'd, you know.
Yeah.
The only reason I can do that fast is because I've done it wrong so many times.
Yeah.
I mean, after a while, you just by accident figure it out almost. Yeah. So it's great that this person has a lot of experience and has been doing that. It's hard for me to know when he says that what he might be talking about, what exactly might be basic common sense to us, but something new for him. You know, I would love to know more about that so I could
Go
there.
But it's probably something that he can't identify.
Maybe.
You know, it may be a long list. Who knows?
Right. But that was a good letter. Let's hear another one.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next one was from Tim Crothers. "Hey, guys, have just stumbled across the podcast yesterday and really been enjoying it, and sounds like you're keen for feedback. I'm a new listener, and the mixing I've done has been live and amateur, not studio, but I enjoy hearing your shop talk and found the episode on EQ particularly helpful. If you did another on compression, as you'd mentioned yourselves, that would also be really interesting. Also, more on vocal EQ and dealing with different voices. Anyway, cheers for doing the show. I'm no professional, so wouldn't expect to direct you back over old ground, but I certainly like listening in and look forward to working backwards and hopefully forwards through your podcast feed." Well, thank you, Tim. Oh. Yeah, EQ with different voices, that's a big can of worms, and I don't know that there's an easy answer to that. It comes.
Well, I can tell you one thing. I can tell you one thing that I personally don't think somebody should do.
Yeah,
I think that it's important not to confuse the order of importance of what the musician is doing versus what the engineer is doing. And the music is always more important. So I've seen situations where an engineer And this might be appropriate if you're doing an album by a big name group, but if it's not something like that, it doesn't help to try 20 vocal mics for the lead singer and completely burn this poor person out before you find one that you like.
Agreed.
I think that's bad form. So
yep.
There's been times when I knew I didn't have a lot of takes with a singer. I just knew it.
Yep.
And so I put a mic out there that I knew would be okay, if maybe it wouldn't be the most perfect thing that's ever happened. You know, I'd win a Grammy for best choice of microphone, something like that.
Yeah.
But I'd put something out there that I know is going to give me a good rendering, right?
Yep.
And not take the time to burn this person into the dust while I try to search for the perfect microphone, which is something that people tend to do when they're learning and they're trying to experiment. And I'm all for experimentation because that's how you make the mistakes that you learn from and all that. But I just think you need to keep in mind that the musicians have to come first and you have to always think about what it looks like from their perspective.
Definitely. And, you know, and on top of that, if they are paying for studio time by the hour, then you need to keep your experimentation to a minimum.
Yes.
Yes. You know, if they've got a limited budget and they really need to get, you know, X number of instrument parts down and it's going to take, you know, 3 or 4 different goes at, you know, tracking all of those instrument parts, then, you know, you need to be mindful of that as an engineer to not burn up their studio time on your experimentation.
I think it's a respect issue. I think that even if you're dealing with musicians that do a style of music that's not to your best taste,
yep.
or even if you're dealing with musicians who haven't been playing very long and have challenges, you have to feel respect for them and what they want to achieve and never forget that. Never yep. forget yep. that. And never put the engineering ahead of them because you've forgotten that.
Yeah.
It's a hard lesson to learn, but yeah. I think it's really important, and it comes out in your vibe, and that vibe makes the musician feel comfortable, and that comfort makes them do a better job. So
definitely,
you end up getting what you want.
Tim, as a new listener to the podcast, I would suggest head back to the website, to signlanguagepodcast.com, and in the search box, type in the name Mike Stavrou, Stavrou. There'll be a couple of episodes back in the archives where I've mentioned a book that Mike wrote called Mixing With Your Mind. And if you want to buy it, the URL for his site is mixingwithyourmind.com. It's an absolutely brilliant book. And one of the things that Mike talks about, and I've mentioned it a couple of times prior to Doc's arrival on the podcast, Mike has this technique or this idea that microphones have a hardness or a softness to their sound. Some, like your cheap Chinese condenser mics, are really brittle, and that you would call that a hard sound, and things like my R84 ribbon mic are a very soft sound. And he, over the course of his career, talked about developing an ear for the sound of the instrument that you're, or voice that you're about to record, and asking yourself, is that a soft, rounded kind of voice, or is it a really harsh, nasally kind of voice? Or, you know, where does it fit on that spectrum? And, you know, Mike talks about building up this repertoire in your mind of, you know, microphones and the way that they sound, and rating them from 1 to 10, where 1 is a soft, rounded sound like a ribbon mic, 10 is a really hard, brittle sound like a cheap Chinese condenser mic, and place these, you know, the voices or the instruments that you're going to record on that same sort of scale, and go for the opposite. So if you've got a voice that's a 1, look for a mic that's a 10. And I haven't really built up a massive repertoire of microphones in my head, but I have kept that idea in my mind when I'm reaching for a microphone to record something. And if it is a guitar sound that's quite harsh and biting, I will always default to my R84.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I totally, I'm on board with that. That makes total sense. Because with the ribbon, you can get a similar frequency response as a different mic, but without that edgy,
exactly.
gnarly quality.
Exactly. Yeah. So
gnarly is a technical term that we use here, you know.
That's right.
In Southern California, you know, things get gnarly, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. So in terms of vocal EQ, Tim, I don't know. I think it's just one of those things that you learn by doing. I don't know that there's any kind of shortcut that is going to point you to dialing in just the perfect EQ for every voice, because every voice is different. And it's just one of those things you learn to listen. And, you know, if it's one voice throughout the entire production, whether that production is a song or a radio commercial or, you know, the soundtrack of a documentary, if there's only one voice, you get a little bit more latitude with how you choose to EQ it. It's when you've got multiple voices interacting with each other that EQ becomes much more, I feel, much more critical that you get it right, because, you know, you can have one voice recorded on one microphone that has a certain tonal quality. You can have a completely different voice recorded on a completely different microphone, and it has a completely different tonal quality because of those two factors. And you need to bear those things in mind as to how they play off each other over the course of whatever that production is. Would you go along with that, Doc?
I would. I would add to it, though. You know, in an earlier show, we talked about not using the same mic for everything in your track.
Because yes.
Everything in your track will have the frequency response of that mic, which in turn leads me to, do not assume that your mic is flat.
Oh, absolutely.
A lot of mics have a boost, and a lot of mics have a mid-range or higher mid-range boost, and a lot of microphones have a little bit of roll-off in the bottom end, and you need to know about that. You need to understand what you have for a microphone, so do your homework on that. I would also say that unless you're playing an instrument with bass notes in it, like, you know, a bass clarinet or a five-string Fender bass or whatever it is, or a four-string bass, unless you're down there vocal-wise, there's nothing below 100 hertz but rumble,
yep,
and stuff that you don't want in your vocal track. There's just nothing down there but trouble, is how I tell my students.
Yeah, definitely.
So I'm not a purist. I'll say that to the beginning. But if you have a singer get real close to a mic, and if that mic is cardioid, you're going to get this thing called proximity effect, where the bass gets boosted. And that can be a problem, because when they pop their consonants, it can get worse if the bass is boosted. So I'd be careful of that. I'd listen for that. I would also say that if you need to add some mid-range or maybe a little higher, like from 2K to 4K, and maybe a little touch at 8K or even higher, if you need to do that to get the vocal to cut through, just remember that as you, and I've said this in past shows, but as you add EQ, it lowers your headroom, because EQ is gain at a specific frequency. So sometimes you can get there by subtractive EQ, which I know Bruce has used,
yeah,
to great effect.
Yeah.
I'd also be careful that if you have other lead instruments, like, for example, you might have a guitar, let's say, you know, a Strat through a Marshall or something like that, and you might find that the same EQ that you use on your voice sounds good on the guitar, don't EQ them the same.
No.
You know, and if you make a track a little darker, it'll recede farther away from the listener.
Yep.
And that can help keep your vocal clear in front.
Yep.
So just think about a few things like that.
Yep. Do you know, there's two things. Oh. One of them's just disappearing on me. One of them was about Reaper. One of them was about, funny. You're talking about the frequency response of a microphone, and if you're using the same microphone on every track, then every track is going to end up with the same sonic footprint, if you like. It's funny, right? Because only in the last week I saw someone mention on, I think it was on a Facebook group, about why he has so many different types of EQ plugins. And he said, you know, because each EQ plugin is engineered a certain way. So, you know, the Q factor responds a certain way, the boost and the cut responds a certain way. And if you're using the same EQ plugin on every track, even with different settings, you're still utilizing this consistent algorithm in the way the EQ is applied. And so he likes to vary the EQ plugin that he uses, because they're all engineered just that little bit differently, which I thought was an interesting concept.
I don't necessarily disagree with the concept, but I will tell you that I use McDSP filter bank more than anything else. And
right.
I have other EQs, but I use it a lot, because you can change the Q and the roll-offs and stuff like that. So, you know, if you think about it, you can get what you want. You just need to make sure that if you don't have a lot of money and you need to get a plugin that will work for most of what you're doing, which is a lot of people's case when they're starting out or just in, under any situation, as long as you have the ability to change the Q factor, which you should look up, it's frequency divided by bandwidth equals Q. So a low Q gives you a wider bandwidth, and a higher Q gives you a sharp bandwidth, which is less musical but can help you get out of trouble with sounds you don't want.
Yeah.
But if you have all the adjustments for shape, Q, boost and cut, you know, shelving or not shelving, you can probably get where you need to go. You can probably get where this person you were talking about can go, but it might be easier if you do have choices. And I don't have anything against choices because I also have other EQs that I do use. I've got, you know, an SSL EQ and I use, that I love, and I've got some API plugins that I like.
Yep.
You know, but I tend to reach for the McDSP first.
Nice.
But I don't always use it the same way.
Right.
And I don't always use the same Q factor, which has a lot to do with how musical the EQ sounds, right?
Right. So, the other thing that I was going to mention, and this was a Reaper-specific thing, and what made this pop into my mind was you talking about when you EQ things a little darker, then they move away from the listener a little bit.
Yeah.
I was mixing a track, this would be 18 months, 2 years ago now, and it was a very dense mix, and there was a lot of guitars, and there was a lot of mid-range in those guitars. And one of the things that I love about Reaper is all of the plugins that you use in it, not only the ones that come with Reaper, like the ones that are native to Reaper, but also third-party plugins, Reaper has this beautiful pin structure paradigm that you can call up, and you can route things, and you can sidechain any plugin, even plugins that weren't designed to be sidechained. And nice. So what I did was I fed a sidechain from the lead vocal to a single band of EQ that I placed across the guitar submix. And I set the center frequency of this EQ at around about 2.5K. And I set the amplitude of the vocal to cause this EQ to go into a dip. So whenever the vocal appeared, this EQ would just dip by a couple of dB at 2.5K. And so what it did was it just sucked out a little bit of that sort of, and I set a fairly wide Q for it. So it was covering like, you know, almost an octave either side. And so it basically just pulled out a lot of the mid-range just when the vocal was evident in the vocal channel. And then when the vocal stopped, that EQ returned to flat.
Yeah, I love that idea. I think that's really good to spread out. That's great.
And it worked
that's
really
well.
Good
to well. Say that.
Yeah, it worked really
well. I'm sure
well.
It did. You know, I'm sure it did. Another thing that, you know, similar to that is you can just have it duck an entire track or group of tracks when the singer comes in, sort of like a commercial. You know,
yeah.
Here comes the dialogue. The music dips automatically. You did it frequency-based. And I think that's really a wonderful idea, and I'm glad that you're sharing that because I think a lot of people will be glad to hear that. It's a good idea.
It's great, but I'm not sure how many other DAWs you could do that in.
Well, most plugins, you know, have a key input these
right.
days, I think.
Yeah.
You know, I can only think of one. Okay, typically, and I get this question a lot, and this is a, sorry, Bruce, this is a Pro Tools question.
That's fine, mate.
It's actually not. It's a plugin question in okay. Pro Tools. But people ask, well, do the native plugins sound as good as the DSP plugins on an HD system, HDX system that has DSP chips?
Right.
And the answer I've always found is that they sound the same, but I have found a couple of plugins, I think they were Focusrite EQs, that the native plugin didn't have a key input and the DSP plugin did.
Right.
But that's rare.
Right.
You can always find another plugin.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare.
Yeah.
And they've probably fixed that by now, so.
Right. Hey, let's get on to another email, because I've got two more emails I want to read, and we're already pushing close on 50 minutes. This was from William LaForge. He said, sad to hear the podcast may be ending. It's been very interesting to me at times, particularly enjoying hearing about preamps, gain staging, harmonic distortion, tube and transformer, acoustics and treatment, there might be a cheaper way, microphones, how they work and how to use them, tracking and mixing techniques, mastering, monitoring in tracking, mixing, and mastering, studio setup and workflow. More on any of these topics is always enjoyed by me. Personally, I'd say nothing beats for talking about preamps and microphones. Knowledge about these two things has helped me immensely. Plus, Doc has a great radio podcast voice. Methods and hardware are interesting to me too. Knowing how things were done before seems to give sense to understanding how they're done now and why. It's always great to hear about specific pieces of hardware too, like the FMR RNC, the really nice compressor, or the Focusrite. He's written Vocal Master. I think he's referring to the Voice Master, but I might be wrong. There might be another product called the Vocal Master. Thanks for the podcast. You seem like classy guys. Good luck in future endeavors. So thank you, William.
I'm glad. It's a good thing you didn't tell me I had a good face for radio. You know, that's, that was next.
So, yeah. You going to say something, Doc?
I was, but it went away.
Okay. You know? So the last email came from one of your students, Mario Carmona. And Mario delivered some pretty cold, hard truths with regarding the podcast and where we've been with it and where I'm at with it and... Yeah, I'll just read his email and then we'll come back and address it.
Before you do, let me just interrupt to say that Mario is one talented cat.
Yeah, right.
Having him as a student was an honor.
Wow.
He's just really talented guy, you know.
Wow.
So shout out to him. You know, he'll probably hear this, but...
yeah, nice. Mario, that's a big call, mate, coming from someone like Doc. That's huge props. So this is what Mario said. Today, I caught up with your last episode. I'm sorry to hear that you don't have a broad audience yet. Hopefully, you'll stay at it. I'm not sure if 7 episodes is enough to generate the critical mass that will make you feel like the energy you're investing is worth it. Now, I'm going to ramble. I'm sure that all of this you might have considered before, but I'll share it with you because you asked for feedback on the podcast. After listening to Bruce's history with the podcast, I agree, this should have been a brand new podcast. The format is nothing like what he had in the past, and I believe that rebranding at the very least should have been a must. Usually, when you find a podcast, you might be drawn by a specific episode. If anyone digs it and wants more, they'll probably be disappointed to hear a completely different format and subject matter. There's also the subject of marketing. I spend most of my budget marketing, and it's my biggest operational expense. I honestly have not ever seen the podcast being advertised anywhere, and I follow the podcast, not on Facebook or anywhere else. If it wasn't for you telling us in class, I would have never found it. In this day and age, not collecting your clients' email addresses is an incredibly missing opportunity to interact with your clients. Yes, your listeners are your clients. If you are concerned about spamming people, don't spam people. There are free, up to a point, services that make emailing and managing your email lists a breeze, like MailChimp.com. But I get it. Where to go from here? I suppose if it was me in your shoes, I would think of bringing well-known people in as guests to your podcast, with the hope that their fans will find your podcast and perhaps a few of them would stick. I would fix the branding issue and remove everything pre-Bruce and Doc. I think that Talking Shop is awesome, but if you could attract people from the capacities of the industry, their fans will be exposed to you, but you'll have to fully take advantage of everything Doc Goldstein has achieved. I really think that after 7 episodes, it's a little early to call it, but you do need to do some house cleaning. I believe podcasts are not going anywhere. If you're successful, you'd be able to reach more people than if you'd written a bestseller book. Mario. Wow. Mario, thank you, mate. I really appreciate the time and effort you put into writing that email, and some of the stuff that you've covered is bang on the money. Like I said, some very cold, hard truths there for me as the, you know, sort of owner of this podcast. Yeah, I suck at marketing. I know that. And it's something I need to deal with, you know.
It's funny.
So, yeah, there's a lot of good stuff there, and I will be addressing a lot of that now that I have time on my hands.
So. Oh, ouch. Yeah. One other thing about Mario I want to say is that he really showed me a place where I could get really great mole chicken. So, you know.
What's mole chicken?
Well, mole sauce is a Mexican sauce. It's made out of I think it's made out of chocolate and chicken stock.
Wow.
And I know that sounds weird, but it's so good on over chicken.
I don't think I've ever heard of that in Australia.
Oh, man.
Next time I'm in the States, you're going to have to bring me up to speed on this.
Oh, yeah. This place is home cooking. I'll take you there.
Nice. Nice. All right.
We digress. Isn't there another one? Is there a fourth? That was the fourth.
The last one that I was going to read. So,
all right. Okay. Well, you know, as far as guests are concerned, I can probably help there.
Sure.
You and I have talked about it offline a little bit.
Yep.
But I haven't asked anybody as of yet.
Sure.
I know plenty of people who are better than I am, in my opinion, you know.
Okay.
You know, I know some people who have done some pretty landmark work.
Right.
And the work that everybody has heard. So
okay.
I need to think about approaching them. So you and I, I'll talk about that offline and we'll see what happens.
For sure.
You know?
All right. I'm not going to address everything that Mario outlined in his email, but believe me, Mario, I am taking your email to heart and I will be looking into all of those things over the coming weeks. Obviously, I do need to look for some work, but I will have some time that I can start to focus on how I can market this podcast better and how I can build the listenership and all that sort of thing. I probably am not going to rebrand the podcast now, given that we're, you know, now not 9 episodes down with Doc. Maybe I think the idea of maybe removing everything prior to Doc, yeah, there's maybe some value in that idea. So these are all things that I will be thinking about over the coming weeks. So, yeah, thank you once again for the time and effort on that email. I really appreciate it.
Before we go, I just want to just say that the other writer who asked about a show on compression, I know that we have talked about that, but maybe we should revisit that.
For sure.
Because it's, you know, compression is such an important topic.
Definitely. Definitely.
You know, so I just want that writer to know that I have not forgotten that request.
No, we can definitely put that on the roadmap for a forthcoming episode. All right, so until we talk with you all again next, take care.
See everybody.
Sign language. Another audiotoyou.com quality podcast. For questions, comments, and feedback, email theboys@signlanguagepodcast.com.